Hi, folks. The Partially Examined Life is on a slight summer break, so in lieu of our regular episode, we're presenting a new podcast effort that I'm doing with Wes. Unlike all of our other side projects, you won't find it on Apple Podcasts. Our central hub for this new effort is patreon.com/closereadsphilosophy. Also, note that all of these episodes will be available via video as well as audio.
This is Close Reads,
a philosophy podcast with Mark and Wes.
I'm Wes Allwyn.
And I'm Mark Lintonmeyer. Wes, are you me? Am I you? Are we all together?
Was I supposed to have read this? Looked at this before?
I'm just asking you intuitively. Are we all one? Are you and I one?
I would want to say no. In the most important senses, no.
Let's see why Emerson might think differently, or whether I'm just mischaracterizing. The Oversoul, his essay from 1841. It starts with some poetry. Do you want to read that, Wes?
Sure. This is a quote from Henry Moore. "But souls that of his own good life partake, he loves as his own self, dear as his eye. They are to him, he'll never them forsake. When they shall die, then God himself shall die. They live in blessed eternity."
So I think we're at least pointing at some intuitive way in which if you love something as your own self, dear, you know, we extend our sense of self. If you want to say maybe everybody is selfish, that's sort of an axiom for some people, then you'd have to qualify that by saying, but I, for instance, regard my family as dear. Maybe I include them as part of myself in some sense. You know, I don't literally, I guess people, this causes relationship issues when you start being harsh with your significant other in the way that you would be harsh with yourself, right? If you are a very self-demanding person, if you are very hard on yourself and you might by nature treat everybody else with some distance and respect, but once they sort of become part of your sphere, then you're just like, what the fuck? What's wrong? What's wrong with you? Mm. You know, you start being as mean to them as you are to yourself, if you're that kind of person.
Right. Well, the subject of this little quotation is God, right?
Souls that
of his own good life partake. So God loves as his own self those that partake of him. He'll never forsake them. When they die, he, God himself, shall die. You know, what's interesting or about this passage, or maybe even metaphysical because it's kind of paradoxical and about God, is this idea that God might die. God might die if the people who partake in him die. We had been talking about Spinoza, where human beings are modes of God, just dependent on God, the only ultimate substance. So this reverses the dependency in a way.
Well, let's read the second quote here, which is not attributed to anybody, but it's a little piece of poetry. Maybe Emerson wrote it himself. I have to assume that. "Space is ample, east and west, but two cannot go abreast, cannot travel in it too. Yonder masterful cuckoo crowds every egg out of the nest, quick or dead, except its own. A spell is laid on sod and stone. Night and day have been tampered with. Every quality and pith, surcharged and sultry with a power that works its will on age and hour." I didn't really anticipate that we'd be doing a poetry examination.
Yeah, it is kind of hard to do poetry in real time. Because this is a complicated one. Cannot travel in it too. Space is ample, east and west.
I mean, there's no room, you might say, why be a monist? Why think that there's only one thing? Well, the notion of God is supposed to be so huge, so overwhelming, that there's no room in the universe for anything else. So that there's a theological basis for why we might want to say, I am you, you are me, we are both God, because God can't exist in a universe where there are things that are not God. So he's like the cuckoo, crowd every egg out of the nest except its own. Mm. That's my best guess here. But how that relates to the last couple lines, I'm not sure. Night and day have been tampered with, every quality and pith, surcharged and sultry with a power that's worked its will on age and hour. Seems like you could have just removed that.
Well, yeah. So it's ending with this idea of night and day have been tampered with. So a spell is laid on sod and stone. So there's something as a divine presence, I guess, in the world. Surcharged, sultry with a power. So that's the second part of this little stanza. It seems like there's an idea of, you know, of a God imminent in nature. Mm-hmm. And the first part, I think the interpretation you gave is a good start. So I think maybe, yeah, we'll have to look at the expository portion of this to start getting an idea. We have a general idea of what Emerson's about. So,
all right. Yeah. You want to start reading the beginning there?
Sure.
This is of the prose itself.
There's a difference between one and another hour of life in their authority and subsequent effect. Our faith comes in moments, our vice is habitual, yet there is a depth in those brief moments which constrains us to ascribe more reality to them than to all other experiences. For this reason, the argument which is always forthcoming to silence those who conceive extraordinary hopes of man, namely the appeal to experience, is forever invalid and vain. We give up the past to the objector, and yet we hope. We must explain hope. We grant that human life is mean, but how did we find out that it was mean? What is the ground of this uneasiness of ours, of this old discontent? What is the universal sense of want and ignorance, but the fine innuendo by which the soul makes its enormous claim? Why do men feel that the natural history of man has never been written, but he is always leaving behind what you have said of him, and it becomes old, and books of metaphysics worthless? These are all still questions, which I... The philosophy of 6,000 years has not searched the chambers and magazines of the soul. In its experiments, there has always remained, in the last analysis, a residuum it could not resolve. Man is a stream whose source is hidden. Our being is descending into us from we know not whence. The most exact calculator has no prescience that somewhat incalculable may not bulk the next very moment. I am constrained every moment to acknowledge a higher origin for events that I will call mine.
All right, so what a mouthful.
Faith comes in moments, our vice is habitual. That's a nice little line. As in, our ordinary habitual mode in life is vicious or filled with vice, and we have these rare moments where we have faith in something more, and I suppose that goes along with virtue.
Yeah, he's saying that we ascribe more reality to these brief moments of faith than to all other experiences. So it seems like he's describing, well, William James' variety of religious experience was later, but I think he was pretty influenced by Emerson, and Emerson certainly has all sorts of mystics in mind, or just the more ordinary, what's the purpose of church is, you know, we have these songs, we have these rituals, we sort of get ourselves in a mindset that we can have faith and hope in a way that you might also be able to do in other ways by looking at the sunset or beholding art or some other things, but it's not the kind of empiricism would sort of say, look to experience, and experience happens all the time, and maybe the Buddhists are right that life is basically suffering. You know, you're uncomfortable more often than you're comfortable. So if we were just reading clearly by like count the moments of your day and in which of them does it seem sort of crappy and which of them does it seem divine? Well, the quantity is going to go to the crappy, but the quality, the ones that we actually emphasize, the ones that stick with us, that we remember, that seem important to us, according to Emerson, are the divine ones.
Yeah, I mean, if we look to experience, I think there's a double meaning there in scientific naturalism, right? So this is evocative of the idea that we are determined. There's a little bit of an existentialist strain to this. And it's also the experience of just, okay, yeah, things have sucked in the past for the most part. And we are sinners and we always fail. And so if we want to conceive of ourselves as free, I know I'm introducing freedom here and that may be illegitimate, we can find out. But if we want to have hope, we are directed towards the future, right? Our projects, maybe. So we give up the past to the objector, and yet we hope. In retrospect, we can always identify the ways in which we are determined and the evidence for the idea that hope is fruitless and there's no such thing as freedom and blah, blah, blah. But he's saying that this objector in a way always loses because there's always a future. Hope is as possible as the fact of our futurity, I guess. But
we're going to have to see whether monism and the stream of time are actually compatible, right? If literally the God, the one, crowds out the nest, every other sort of egg, then it seems like, as it says, it works its will on age and hour. In other words, it's equally distributed over all these things. Then it could be that it's sort of illusory, the fact that the future is different than the past. Maybe we have to say that time is an illusion, or I'm just throwing open an issue possibly to address here.
Yeah. The philosophy of 6,000 years has not gotten to the bottom of things, basically. So at the end of this paragraph, we're left with this idea that the absurdity, by which I mean the inexplicability of whatever is at the foundation, of our source as human beings, whatever drives us, maybe you could say, whatever we might take to be instinctual, or maybe that's the wrong word, but human essence is something that we can't plumb philosophically. So there's a little hint here that the, you know, that only some sort of mysticism is going to be adequate to this. This is part of the response to the idea that everything is determined, and when we look at the past, we can see that in retrospect, and that we are just animals and driven by needs and desires and things like that. I'm constrained every moment to acknowledge a higher origin for events than the will I call mine. So regardless of how things look from an experience or naturalistic standpoint, there's a mystery there, which points to something divine, points to a higher origin.
Right. And it's, you know, a sentence from the middle, what is the universal sense of want and ignorance, but the fine innuendo by which the soul makes its enormous claim that this is an inescapable thing, this religious urge or whatnot, that its seeds, the seeds of optimism are right there in the pessimistic observations of the world, right?
Mm.
You know, we only very notice good. And react to suffering because the next steps of the Buddhist path or whatever are there, that there is a way out of suffering. There is, you know, there's has to be hope. All right, let's keep
part
going.
And part of our suffering is spiritual, which.
Yeah. As with events, so it is with thoughts. When I watch that flowing river, which out of regions I see not, pours for a season its streams into me, I see that I am a pensioner, not a cause, but a surprised spectator of this ethereal water, that I desire and look up and put myself in the attitude of reception, but from some alien energy, the visions come. I think that it's just saying in poetic way words what we've already said here. But what is this? When I watch that flowing river, which out of regions I see not, pours for a season its streams into me. So it's sort of, this is getting at if the one, the whole, is something that we participate in, well, it is dynamic. It is not merely something atemporal, as I was just musing about, where we discover that past and present are in fact one, but it is a flowing river. And at least the way that we show up is that being flows into us for a while and then we die and it's gone. It keeps on flowing, but not through. I'm a mere surprise spectator of this ethereal water.
Yeah. From some alien energy, the visions come. This is sort of like our relationship to the muse in the context of art,
right.
Or our relationship to instinct. So there's something at bottom which drives us, that pours its streams into us. And
it doesn't sound here like he's talking about
freedom. We are dependent on that. We are not in control. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like here that he's emphasizing freedom.
No. Yeah. Here he's emphasizing dependency on some version of the divine. It does sound very Spinozan, God is nature type of thing. But
yeah, keep on going.
All right. The supreme critic on the errors of the past and the present, and the only prophet of that which must be, is that great nature in which we rest, as the earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere. That unity, that oversoul, within which every man's particular being is contained and made one with all other, that common heart of which all sincere conversation is the worship, which all right action is submission, that overpowering reality which confutes our tricks and talents and constrains everyone to pass for what he is, and to speak from his character and not from his tongue, and which evermore tends to pass into our thought and hand, and become wisdom and virtue and power and beauty.
All right, let's stop there.
Yeah, just, go ahead.
Yeah, this is going to be a long paragraph. So, what do we think?
Long paragraphs. But
what do we think so far of that? I mean, that it is describing this river as the soft arms of the atmosphere, that unity, the oversoul, which within every man's particular being is contained and made one with all other, that common heart of which all sincere conversation is the worship. So it is something we're contained within. It therefore makes us one with each other. That seems weird right there, right? The fact that, you know, the universe is something we're contained in. And so you and I are fellow creatures in the universe. That doesn't make me you, right? So it has to be containing seems a strange, you know, we have to, if you think of it as like the Jungian collective unconscious or something like that, then, I mean, in a sense, it's a portal basically in my head, right? It's part of my unconscious. So it's contained within me. But if it is quantitatively the same within me as it is in yours, they're not just copies of each other that we inherit Well, this is a question. They could be qualitatively identical, right? Because we have similar DNA. And so the group memories, the whatever this is, parading back into infinity is going to be the same qualitatively in me than in you. But if we want to say that we are one, then we're not merely like each other. They have to be numerically identical. They have to, you know, be one and the same thing, which is why I characterized it as like, we each have a portal in us and the portal goes to the same place. It is the oversoul. Maybe the oversoul is still something that contains all of us, but we have to, in that sense, contain it. I'm not sure how to match these metaphors together of containment. It contains us, and yet we're all one. It's a connecting force.
Well, as he said, we're all one yet.
Which every man's particular is contained and made one with all other. So my particular being is one with all other being. That common heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a common heart. Does that mean we have similar hearts? We have the heart of humanity. I have the heart of humanity. You have the heart of humanity. Or do we literally, metaphysically, have the same heart? You know, that the spirit of God, which is one, is within all of us. You know, the Holy Ghost.
Yeah, I mean, I think trying to work this out metaphysically will create some problems. But so he starts out by talking about nature as the supreme critic, which is a really interesting way to think of nature, especially given the direction that he's going with this idea of oversoul and unity. Supreme critic of the errors of the past and the present, which I think has something to do with natural consequences, right? So it sounds like in this paragraph, he's giving an account of the way in which our aspirations are thwarted, the best laid plans of mice and men. So which, you know, every man's later on, overpowering reality, which confutes our tricks and talents, constrains everyone to pass for what he is, right? So we might try to transcend our character, but we end up repeating it and being constrained by it. This goes back to habit in the first paragraph. But on the other hand, we end with something positive, which is some of the Aristotelian virtues. So which character can be the basis for. But anyway, sorry, I'm just trying to reconcile that with the middle part of this, which is about, as you said, the oversoul and the unity of our being. It's interesting. So, the common heart, if it belongs to all human beings, he calls sincere conversation the worship of that. So that is our way of communion. And this is an interesting idea, right? Because we might think of communion, properly speaking, as being with God, being with this divine otherworldly entity. At least that's where the worship is directed, mm-hmm. right? We don't think of the worship as towards the community itself. So this, in a way, this seems to recast God or the divine as the collective. But then, I'm not so sure of that now, because that overpowering reality. So I guess it's the same thing. You know, if nature and collective humanity somehow come to the same thing, then this all makes sense to some extent. I don't know how to resolve the metaphysical questions.
Well, it has to be. So it's the ennobling part of us. I mean, it's God. It's right. The only proper attitude is submission, is worship.
Yeah.
But God has a particular relationship to us. That it connects us with each other. It is, we each have a divine spark or something within us, however we want to. And not only does it constrain each one to pass for what he is and, confutes our tricks and talents. In other words, like it is our nature that we ultimately have to submit to just because that's the kind of finite creatures we are. But it ennobles us. It becomes wisdom and virtue and power and beauty. And so by surrendering to this, it's not like we're surrendering to our brute nature. You're trying to be all noble, but you're really just a stupid animal and just go act like that. Like, no, what we really are these divine luminous beings. And so submitting to that is actually pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, there's two senses of submission, I think, in this part of the paragraph. One is nature punishes our folly, our tricks and talents, our attempt to overpower it. And we are overpowered in that sense. But ultimately, I think once we get shaped and we're kind of driven through experience towards the development of these virtues. So if we let nature slash God slash oversoul speak through us, then instead of fighting. But all right, yeah. Should we keep going?
Sure. Leave the next part.
Yep. We live in succession and division in parts and particles. Meantime, within man is the soul of the whole. the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one.
Capital O, deep... capital N, capital E.
And this deep power in which we exist and whose beatitude is all accessible to us is not only self-sufficing and perfect in every hour, but the act of seeing and the thing seen, the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object are one. We see the world piece by piece as the sun, the moon, the animal, the tree, but the whole of which these are the shining parts is the soul. Only by the vision of that wisdom can the horoscope of the ages be read. And by falling back on our better thoughts, by yielding to the spirit of prophecy, which is innate in every man, we can know what is saith.
Let's stop there. I think sort of disregarding the last part, you know, that we have where we're starting to talk about prophecy and but we have the more of the metaphysics here. We live in succession. So again, time, it seems like this has to ultimately be overcome, right? We live in division. We live in parts. We live in particles. If we focus on just that one time slice, you don't actually see the universe. You don't have, you know, that portal is not there. Meanwhile, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal ones, eternal. So this just sounds like there is this portal or whatever that can transcend unitary experiences, which, again, per the first paragraph, are probably mostly of irritation and suffering and doubt.
Portal, where are you getting portal?
I'm just trying to figure what would make sense. What does it mean to you within the soul of the whole? I mean, I'm sort of imagining that there is ever present within us. Right now, the focus of your consciousness might be the activity that you're involved in, the feelings of, you could do a whole phenomenology of the moment, but there's always going to be sort of in the back of your mind, if you just look back there, some sort of divine spark. I was saying portal because it seems like a way that you could, if you focus very much on that, you could enter some sort of mystical state and realize, you could sort of identify with that rather than with this upfront momentary stuff. But that's just my guess at what would be a useful doors of perception, man.
Yeah. I would put, I would put some emphasis here on the transcendentalist thing that's going on, which is to say that he really does seem to be identifying God with nature. And we can think of this in terms of, the end point of naturalistic explanation, right? So if we, because he's evoking that in his talk of parts and particles, we can give a causal explanation and we can give one that involves us drilling down vertically, so to speak, and dividing things up into parts and maybe getting to some ultimate atom or to some fundamental force. And then that fundamental force is inexplicable. And you could think of it as quote unquote being per se, whatever that is. You could think of that bedrock layer, maybe the undersheet, for some reason I was thinking of the bed and the fitted sheet that goes under everything. But anyway, whatever the base, layer, the tablecloth of reality along which everything is upon which everything is laid out. Whatever that thing is at bottom, you could call this that. It's mysterious. It's uncaused. It can't be explained. It unites everything in the sense that it is the concatenating force, right? Something is making atoms or subatomic particles do what they do and why. I mean, there's no good reason for them to behave that way. And so we refer to that mystery, that fundamental force. You can see how that would inspire awe and a sense of mystery. And then that can become the basis for a relationship to the divine. And I completely understand this feeling. It's a kind of like, when I look at these deep field shots that have tons of galaxies in them, and I think about the scale of things and the craziness of it, right? Just the kind of unlikely nature of it all. It you know, it induces a little bit of a religious feeling in me, even though I'm not religious and I don't, in a way, I don't get religion. That's why I have problems with our Eastern quasi-religious episodes. In a way, it's like the idea of a personal God is very foreign to me because I didn't grow up with it. So, but this type of thing, you know, I at an intuitive level, I get it.
All right. Well, so setting aside the, right, if I use that metaphor of a door, that implies that the godhood is elsewhere. You were saying it's just nature. We're within nature. So that, you know, we're in the container and nature is, you know, our DNA. Oh, I'm so similar to you. We have such similar DNA and we have such similar DNA to all that. You know, we could say there are things literally inside us that are codes and symbols and representatives of nature and sort of enforce nature's will on us, right? By obeying instinct, by obeying DNA, by obeying, you know, what's been pumped into me by evolution since the dawn of life.
You know, we're familiar with this, like in Schopenhauer, where what is the thing in itself? The will, ultimately. And there's a big over-will of which all will is a part that turns out to be God. And we are intimately familiar with the thing in itself. We're not cut off from it, as Kant would say, because we're inside it. We know what it's like to be, you know, we have wills. We know personally what it's like to be a thing in itself in a way. And the same thing with, you know, I think Hegel, where what is it to know the fundamental reality? It's to know oneself. Substance ultimately turns out to be subject. All that kind of stuff, I think. And then what we were seeing in Schlegel, the Schlegels and Schiller with the relationship to the absolute, being an aesthetic relationship and aware of the infinite in the finite, right? There are elements of that here. But for Emerson, that awareness of the infinite in the finite in the parts and the particles and the rest of it and individual human beings, that infinite, I think he thinks, you know, has something to do with instinct maybe, right? So instead of Schopenhauerian will, it's not like they're unrelated, but these deep drives, maybe even unconscious. But anyway, that's a bit of speculation here. So
yeah, if you don't get any of those references, well, you know, you can catch up on the Partially Examined Life.
I hope you're enjoying Close Reads. All Close Reads episodes are shot with video and will always provide a link to the text so you can read along if you'd like. Enrollment for my Core Texts in Philosophy class, running over 10 non-consecutive weeks this fall, is now open. Get details at partiallyexaminedlife.com/class. Space is very limited, so act quickly. I want to tell you about a much beloved podcast, Drilled, a true crime podcast about climate change. You may often wonder why oil companies spend so much money producing feel-good ads unrelated to what the companies actually do. On Drilled's new miniseries, Herb, host Amy Westervelt tells the story of Herb Schmertz, the mobile VP who got the oil guys into the corporate free speech business back in the 1970s. Amy uncovers how Herb's work influenced all this nefarious feel-good messaging from oil companies today and explores mobile's role in setting the legal foundation for the expansion of corporate free speech in Supreme Court cases from Bellotti to Citizens United. Listen to Drilled wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's keep going here. So now we get some practical stuff out of this. Only by the vision of that wisdom can the horoscope of the ages be read. By falling back on our better thoughts, by yielding to the spirit of prophecy, which is innate in every man, can we know what it saith. Every man's words, who speaks from that life, must sound vain to those who do not dwell in the same thought on their own part. I dare not speak for it. My words do not carry its august sense. They fall short and cold. Only itself can inspire whom it will, and behold, their speech shall be lyrical and sweet and universal as the rising of the wind. Yet I desire, even by profane words, if I may not use sacred, to indicate the heaven of this deity, and to report what hints I have collected of the transcendent simplicity and energy of the highest law.
All right. Finally, we get the word transcendent.
Transcendent simplicity. So I had, you know, said that this was practical. It's practical in what he's already said, that, you know, we get wisdom, we get prophecy, he says here, we can... Well, I mean, why is the spirit of prophecy innate in every man, other than what he's just said, that we innately think, according to this, that history will progress, that things will get better, that the irritations of the day, the holes that have been in past philosophy, it just points to those holes being filled, to there being a fullness, to be there being a progression, a hope. I mean, is this the same as just that the medievals, I'm conscious that I am finite, And so that implies a yearning, looking for epistemologically the infinite, right? That's what prophecy here amounts to, is that things have been a little bad so far. And that just cries out again for an expectation that they will be better.
Yeah. Only by the vision of that wisdom. If the spirit of prophecy is innate in every one of us, it has to be in the sense in which we are all part of the Oversoul and in touch at a deep level with the force that imbues everything and runs everything. So that if we get in touch with that, then we can be prophetic or have the spirit of prophecy. And then the question is what prophecy means, right? Because in the biblical sense, it is specifically about the coming of a savior. In a more generic astrological sense, or maybe not just astrological, but it's just about future, predicting the future, including calamities, right? What's that guy's name? Nostradamus?
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but it's probably not that kind of prophecy. But I mean, the way he continues here, it's almost like he's saying there's something poetic about it. It almost sounds like the idea of prophecy kind of fuses with the ability to be poetic, to express, again, the absolute through the aesthetic. And he gets modest. I dare not speak for it. My words do not carry its august sense. Well, Emerson, you're up there towards the top. It's a little bit of false modesty. Calls his words profane instead of sacred. He knows that his writing kicks ass, right? Who can write like this? Almost no one. So what he's doing, I think, counts as part of the spirit of prophecy that he's talking about. Just being in touch with this transcendent Oversoul.
Yeah, I mean, this raises a question of the overall adequacy of language to express this thing that we have in common. Mm-hmm. And I'm, again, thinking of, we just, on Partially Examined Life, dealt with the romantics, and that the best that language can do is symbolize and point to. And that's what he's doing right here. He's saying, these words I'm saying can't actually do it. But if you look within yourself as a response to my words, then you're going to be able to experience that thing. And, you know, insofar as you are trying to speak of it, you can never do justice to it any more than I can in talking right now. But maybe what holy words are, or is a sort of a shared indefinite reference to something that each of us experiences only internally. I mean, maybe all emotion words should do the same thing. Not to pull us into a whole Wittgensteinian.
Yeah, I knew. I knew you wanted to go there. Private language.
Yeah, but that's essentially what he's been saying, is that you can see, whether you want to call it a portal or a germ or a divine presence or something, you know, this thing that clearly you must experience in some sense, because you can sometimes get flashes of it and you can submit to and all this stuff that he's talking about, then, hey, your speech will be lyrical and sweet and universal. So somehow, even though you're talking, relating your private experience, because it has the same source as mine, because we have the same thing at bottom within us, then it's going to be universal.
Yeah, you're reminding me of our Schlegel episode and the distinction between style and manner. Particular artistic product can be a result of my quirks of character, my particular character, and so mannered in that sense, but I can turn that into a style. And this is hints of Nietzsche here, but, you know, if I do something conscious with it and own it and I'm not just run by it, I can turn it into a style. And then there is only one style ultimately, and that's universal, right? So if we really, if all of us really worked on ourselves to the point where we were fashioning our particular characters and it's the aesthetics of that and the aesthetic products of that, and to develop them to our fullest, to develop them to their fullest would cause them to converge. And so there's always the element of the universal in that. So thankfully we're not there, right? So we get to enjoy a variety of different styles, even if it means they're corrupted a little bit by manner. But anyway, I can continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
If we consider what happens in conversation, in reveries, in remorse, in times of passion, in surprises, in the instructions of dreams, wherein often we see ourselves in masquerade, the droll disguises only magnifying and enhancing a real element and forcing it on our distinct notice, we shall catch many hints that will broaden and lighten into knowledge of the secret of nature. All goes to show that the soul in man is not an organ, but animates and exercises all organs. It is not a function, like the power of memory or calculation or comparison, but uses these as hands and feet, is not a faculty, but a light, is not the intellect or the will, but the master of the intellect and the will, is the background of our being in which they lie, an immensity not possessed and that cannot be possessed. From within or from behind, a light shines through us upon things and makes us aware that we are nothing, but the light is all. A man is the facade of a temple wherein all wisdom and all good abide. What we commonly call man, the eating, drinking, planting, counting man, does not, as we know him, represent himself, but misrepresents himself. Him we do not respect, but the soul, whose organ he is, would he let it appear through his action, would make our knees bend. When it breathes through his intellect, it is genius. When it breathes through his will, it is virtue. When it flows through his affection, it is love. And the blindness of the intellect begins when it would be something of itself. The weakness of the will begins when the individual would be something of himself. All reform aims in some one particular to let the soul have its way through us. In other words, to engage us to obey.
So I guess we're God's automatons. We're God's hand puppets. And if we're so, I don't want to be a hand puppet. I want to do my own thing. Then, you know, we introduce weakness of the will. We introduce blindness of the intellect. We're denying our fundamental, not freedom, unless we end up identifying
very Taoist,
with the freedom.
Right?
Yeah.
It sounds kind of Taoist and the don't struggle. Just let go, man. Get in touch with that force that flows through you. Am I getting at
I think so. And we get some hints here. Is the light, you know, what is the proper metaphor? All goes to show that the soul in man is not an organ, but animates and exercises all the organs. So we don't want to say a principle. It is a force. I mean, it seems like it is the agency of the body, right? If we want to say nature sets up us up with as systems, you know, we've got this little bit of thing that is our consciousness that is, what am I going to do today? I'm going to go eat some breakfast. But then we have all these wider systems set up by nature that are thinking, in a sense, that are, you know, even in deciding, I think I'm making this free choice to eat breakfast or whatever, it's actually the system as a whole that is engaging the little conscious reasoning part of us to say,
sure,
do this job for me. I mean, so this sounds like what you were saying, as it's nature, but it's not nature as a giant clockwork mechanism. It's nature as God. And the difference of that is it's progressive, and the different systems need to be somehow aware of each other in a way that they wouldn't be if every little thing in nature was just a little clockwork mechanism that evolution had built, because then there would be no necessary connection between my mechanism and your mechanism, or even within ourselves. We might have individual mechanisms that, you know, are trying to do this thing. Like he's clearly, by saying there could be weakness of the will, he's allowing that there are these systems that can get out of joint, but we want them to ultimately harmonize with all of the other systems. And that is what submission to God's will, although he's not saying it in that way, is submission to nature.
Yeah, you're reminding me of Nietzsche's emphasis on drive harmony as a form of freedom in the psychological sense, right? He's very down on metaphysical free will, but there's that psychological integration version of freedom where you don't have all these conflicting drives that are, you know, the drive conflicts are resolved and the right drive is kind of in charge. It's not the will that's in charge, but it's the Uber drive. But I like this, you know, the eating, drinking, counting man, planting, he misrepresents himself. So all of these ego instincts, all of these survival things that we do, our animal selves are, you know, when we look at ourselves through that lens, yeah, we're just animals, and it's kind of a hopeless point of view. There is nothing higher, and
you're just gonna get hungry again. Why bother?
Yeah, yeah. And then, but so the idea of misrepresentation, you know, these things are driven by the divine in a way. They're manifestations. I think you were saying something like it runs the body, or so. And then it's when we try, so it does sound very instinctual in a way, or there's some aspect of instinct which through which we can tap into a relationship to the divine and let that run us, let that speak through us. Again, a variation on the inspiration by the muse. So, and then it's when we try, right? The blindness of the intellect begins when it would be something of itself, when it's not submitting to this force. The weakness of the will begins. You know, so here he's recasting the weakness of the will, not as, oh, I have all these instincts and my reason can't properly suppress it. I'm not, you know, I don't have a strong enough will. No, it's actually when we try to interfere too much, when we don't go with the flow, that type of thing crops up for us. And there's there's kind of a truth to that, right? The more we try to control ourselves, the more we kind of rebel. The more relaxed, the more we relax a little bit, sometimes paradoxically, that can help us with our habits. But anyway.
All right, let's see if we can do a couple more paragraphs. Of this pure nature, every man is at some time sensible. Language cannot paint it with his colors. It is too subtle. It is undefinable, unmeasurable, but we know that it pervades and contains us. We know that all spiritual being is in man. A wise old proverb said, God comes to see us without bell. That is, as there is no screen or ceiling between our heads and the infinite heavens, so there is no bar or wall in the soul where man, the effect, ceases and God, the cause, begins. The walls are taken away. We lie open on one side to the deeps of spiritual nature, to the attributes of God. Justice we see and know, love, freedom, power. These natures no man ever got above, but they tower over us, and most in the moment when our interests tempt us to wound them. I'm trying to figure out as we go through here, are we able to identify with the divine nature? I mean, it seems like that is going to be the point. Hey, you think you're just the eating, drinking, counting man, but that's not what humanity is at all. You, the person who's hearing these words, are in fact this power, this underlying power, and rather than identify yourself with the measly little systems within it, the effects within it, the things that are blind to the larger scheme, you should just realize that you actually are God. Mm. But you can't really feel that exactly. I mean, you could have a mystical experience. You could have a general sense of grace. You could have a sense of the Holy Spirit, however you want to put it. You know, we can't do ESP. If I'm one with everything, I should be able to tell where my keys are upstairs without having to go look for them. I should be able to tell where your keys are, even though I don't know where you put them. And that doesn't work. So there always has to be, it seems, some division.
It's even worse than that, because it's not just that you're God. It's Betty from HR is also God, the one who lets like the grease from her sandwich drip down her face at lunchtime and is completely absent-minded and mindless. She's God as well. Everyone has God speaking through them. Anyway, the point of that joke is just to point out that like our fallenness and our folly, those are the most obvious things about humanity, all the stupid things we do. It's very hard to get into this frame of mind. Maybe it's easier with oneself, you know, if you meditate or if you're engaged in an artistic project where you're in the flow, so to speak, you can, I think, get into this idea that you're tapping into some divine source that is within and underlies all things, and that you are more than just your finite self. But if you think about humanity as a whole, this is the way the essay began. You know, if you look at it from the standpoint of hindsight and the critical frame of mind, I think it's very hard to see people, human beings, as God, right?
Yeah. So maybe it's more the hope that you see the potential within each of us, no matter where we're at, to
even Betty
to have this
from HR.
But this points at something of the way this is typically talked about is increasing self-consciousness, or somehow an expansion of consciousness. Expand your mind, expand your consciousness. And so you could say that the human being, as someone who has some possible distance, I'm thinking of the Schiller that we just read in Partially Examined Life, that we can abstract, we can reason, we can pull ourselves away from merely being determined, which will get us into all of the sort of suffering and conflicts with each other, conflicts within ourselves. I'm not optimistic about non-human creatures, certainly not rocks and plants, being able to expand themselves, you know. So if
those motherfuckers are never going to learn.
Right, right. Yeah. So, you know, where is the line? Like, are we really thinking that, like Schiller was trying to argue, that we could engineer a social program of consciousness raising, wokeism, let's call it, to use a more original source for that term.
Hey, Emerson was the original wokist.
Yes.
Transcendental awakening.
It was not merely recognizing some particular historical facts about racism or about whatever, but it was about literally realizing our relation to the divine. And somehow that would, I mean, you can't be a sectarian. You can't be a racist if you're like, we're all basically one. Right. You know, every human being that has this power of language and hence the power of abstraction is able to get at in a way that maybe animals are not, or maybe animals always do. And it's just that language has introduced to us a fallenness. And maybe this is the solution, that actually rocks and plants don't have to get back in touch with their nature. They're already in there. And even though there's conflicts and the trees in the forest are going to try to crowd each other out, and I'm going to take your shade and you're going to take my shade, and the carnivores are going to eat the herbivores and the herbivores are going to eat the plants, all that kind of conflict, that's fine. They don't have to get over that. But
not,
that's not like war. Yeah. That's not like our hatred and prejudice. We do need, that's only a result of our fallen humanity, and we can get over that.
Our divided nature, you know. Part of God, part of animal, and reason versus instinct, all that stuff. So we are divided in the way that other natural entities are not. They're naturally at one with themselves. But I want to say, even though your woke thing was an aside / maybe a bit of a joke, there is very interesting connection, because it is a consciousness-raising activity, right? In the tradition of Marx and trying to help the proletariat, for instance, understand, awaken to the ideology of the bourgeoisie, right? Who say, oh, this class system is natural and just is just the way things are. That ideological misrepresentation of what is natural and inevitable, that's part of the woke critique. So what we're for the woke, and as you know, as everyone knows by now, I'm very critical of this, but I'm also thinking a lot about it in an attempt to be fair. But the idea is that you are waking up to the power of discourse to construct your identity. So what you're becoming aware of, if you're saying wokeness in a way is about getting in touch with your own racism, it's not just your racist unconscious biases, but even though that's often what people mean, it's the way in which your discourse has constructed your identity as complicit in a certain type of power relation. So for instance, whiteness, and you can conceive of that, which is like a character trait, right? It's a part and parcel of character under this theory. And you could be constructed so as to have an inherently supremacist point of view. Whiteness could be a concept that depends upon some subjected other. That could be the very meaning of it. And that could be built into your identity. So what you wake up to in that sense is not just the divine power in you, but the way discourse, and by the way, discourse is the replacement for God, right? Because it ultimately starts with, discourse is just a linguistic version, a descendant of Hegel's absolute. Ultimately, there's nothing outside of the text, right? Discourse just becomes the whole in which we are embedded. So that is our God, and unfortunately, it's not entirely a good God. We could be corrupted by it, and we have to reform it. We have to make it better and then reconstruct ourselves according to that discourse. Anyway, I just think you brought up a very interesting point connecting it to the concept of an ideological awakening, right? Consciousness raising. I think that's very important.
Sure. And just like, I mean, I'm also trying to think that the romanticism that a lot of this is reflecting was also co-opted by fascism. And so there seems to be room here, right? Nietzsche thought that it's certainly not everybody. He didn't have hope that most people, that Betsy from HR or whatever is, are going to be able to raise themselves. You know, he was explicitly.
It's Betty, Mark, not Betsy, and she's tired of that mistake.
You know, he was self-consciously an elitist, and so there is room to. I think elitism is an easier path than somehow the German national spirit is going to be able to be woke in this way, but yet those foreigners are not. Like, that seems, no, you should be an elitist even among your own people and say it's only the German intellectuals are going to be able to do this kind of thing. But Emerson, as an American, as a good American, was probably thinking in much more egalitarian terms. And I think language is maybe the key here, as he said, discourse, that anybody who's capable of discourse is capable of this consciousness raising. And I like the idea that anybody that is not really capable of this discourse doesn't have the problem to solve in the first place. I'm not sure if this is really a good thing to write into Emerson, but it certainly makes the whole thing. Well, I'm just, even human beings that, you know, have a developmental disability, you know, children, very small children. I remember talking to somebody, a relative of mine.
So rocks, children, who else?
Who was saying, like, oh, children, they're so in touch. They kind of speak the language of nature. They don't need to. Part of me thinks that is really silly. That is, you know, because you could see how profoundly selfish children are.
Yeah.
Insofar as they can explain anything, how, you know, if there's not somebody that has weakness of the will or is blind, if a baby is not that, I don't know what is. But know, we could at least explore, at least it solves the problem of elitism. Maybe it replaces with the problem of being patronizing, that, oh, it's okay. You don't have to become woke. You're already just, you know, an idiot savant, basically, that is already in touch with nature. And so, unlike me, an intellectual who is a fallenness to my, I'm trying to remember which piece of literature I'm recalling that, sure, I'll remember it, but where this character is, you know, watching the ordinary people and the way that they deal with each other and like, oh, that's so natural. And I am so alone. I think this was Siddhartha Hermann Hesse. That's what I'm thinking of. Oh, I, as the poor misunderstood intellectual, I am so alone. If only I could recover that innocent character. I mean, yeah, so that's the sort of patronizing thing that would be replaced by
of all the rednecks around me. If only I could go to the monster truck rally.
Yeah, they actually enjoy themselves.
And be able to enjoy that. And
they can enjoy sporting events and drink. And I just, oh.
Well, I have to go, but I will say I do frequently wonder what the fuck I'm doing plowing my way through philosophy texts as opposed to going monster, when I could just be drinking beer and relaxing. But anyway, whatever.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for hanging around this. Yeah. We'll talk about whether, maybe you can make some comments. Do you want to hear more of this Emerson stuff? Or do you feel like, you know, we probably got the point?
No, I'm enjoying this too much.
All right, then we'll do.
We're going to do it all.
Let's promise a part two. And based on the amount of this, I would say a part three. But maybe we can.
Well, I think we can start. We started going faster, and I think we can move a little bit more quickly now. But yeah.
All right. So long, everybody. Right.
Thank you.
If you enjoy Close Reads, go subscribe at patreon.com/closereadsphilosophy or support the Partially Examined Life and Close Reads together at patreon.com/partiallyexaminedlife, signing up at the $10 a month Citizen Plus tier. Either way, you'll be paying $5 a month for at least 4 episodes per month. There are 3 more parts to this Emerson discussion, and they will all be up there within this week. We also, prior to this, recorded a 3-part series on Hegel's History of Philosophy lectures, specifically the section on Spinoza. Those are already available for you. And again, all of them are in podcast audio form like this, as well as in video form. In either case, they are very minimally edited, which might mean listening at a slightly higher speed than you would listen to a PEL episode. I don't know how you listen to podcasts or watch YouTube. But the point is that we're inviting you to our little study session, just like if you were on the Zoom call with us muted. Depending on the level of support for this new project, we'd like to record them more than once a week. We'd like to have special Q&A episodes, but whether we can afford to put in that extra time depends entirely on how many supporters we get for this. Now, if you've never supported a podcast on Patreon before, they make it very easy. They give you a unique podcast feed URL. You just click on it if you're logged in from your phone, and it will open the supporter podcast in your default podcast app. You can use any podcast app, and actually, Patreon is now partners with Spotify. So if you're a Spotify listener, you can listen to your supporter feed right through that. In any case, we encourage your feedback, your suggestions on what texts to cover in this format at closereads@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks for listening.